This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
I'm your host, April Chatham Carpenter, and I'm here today with my co-host, Glenn White. Get ready for today's conversation with a community leader in Arkansas who's helping Arkansans work towards solutions across the political aisle. Glenn, who will we be talking with today?
April, I'm pretty excited today. We have Dr. Vic Snyder join us on our podcast. Vic, as many listeners will know, served as the U.S. Congressman for the 2nd Congressional District in Arkansas for several years. Before that, he had a successful career as a physician, an attorney, and he is a veteran, having served in the Marines. Currently, he is married to the Reverend Betsy Singleton, and they have 4 children. So, Vic, welcome to On the Other Hand. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be with you. I do need to correct one thing. I never had a successful career as an attorney. I was a successful law student and passed the bar and then went back immediately to practicing medicine, but I never made any money practicing law.
Okay. Well, that's helpful to know.
I never tried to make money practicing law.
So. Gotcha. You just liked the extra education. I'm sure it came in handy when you got to Congress. Okay. Well, let's start, Vic. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you to this point in life.
Well, I'm at an age that could be like a 2-hour discussion if you start, I was born and raised by a pack of wolves in southern Colorado. I was raised in southern Oregon and a long ways from Arkansas and spent about 6 years between my sophomore and junior year of college, not in college, including 2 years in the Marine Corps and doing some other kinds of work for a community action program and worked for the post office for a while and worked as a hospital orderly and some other things like that. Went back for my junior and senior year in Oregon at a small school similar to our Hendrix here in Arkansas, Willamette University, and was interested in getting the science courses to qualify to be a physician's assistant. Did okay at the science. I thought, well, why don't I do one more year and see if I could get into medical school. Got into medical school in Oregon and then matched to do my residency here in Arkansas on family practice. The MATS program is where, the programs put in what they need and the students rank them, and then some magic computer program says, okay, you're going here or there. So I ended up in Arkansas. That was in 1979 to do my residency, and I have been here ever since, with the exception of doing some work overseas. As far as the political aspects of my life, when I was a kid in Southern Oregon, I actually began doing volunteer work in political campaigns back then for Republican candidates in Southern Oregon. We called our little group the Teenage Republicans. I parked cars for Nelson Rockefeller when he was on the 1964 political campaign trying to win the Oregon primary, and did some other campaigns back there for local races, but. So that was when I was in high school. Decades later, I credit what I learned by going door to door as a for candidates in Southern Oregon in the mid '60s for why I won some of my races here in Arkansas. Decades later, but maybe that's enough of an intro.
That's a good start. We'll ask you some other questions and go from there. I find it fascinating. Then, if I understand you right, then you started off kind of working with the Republican Party in Oregon, is that right?
Yeah, when I was in high school, my friends were part of the Republican Party. There was, and I was. I would think it's probably fair to say that the Oregon Republican Party in the mid '60s was probably pretty dramatically different from the way it is now. I think there are probably people who are part of the Republican Party. Back in Oregon at that time, that would not have a chance in a Republican primary now. Just the nature of how the Republican Party has changed. I mean, the senators were like Mark Hatfield, and my congressman was a guy named John Dellenbach, who went on to become head of the Peace Corps. He may have been the first, I can't remember, he may have been one of the first leaders of the Peace Corps, but they're very dynamic guys, but it was a robust two-party system at that time in Oregon.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, Mark Hatfield, he was fairly liberal, was he not?
Mark Hatfield, everybody loved Mark Hatfield until his record pointed out how hypocritical the rest of us were. He took a strong position against the death penalty. He took a strong position against the war in Vietnam, and he took a strong position against abortion. And it's pretty easy to see his internal consistency in those positions. It's probably fair to say most of the rest of America, we had inconsistencies in our views. But he was actually a Willamette University like student body president where I went to school, and then he was governor of Oregon. He was a very, very nice man, real smart guy, and as most the great majority of elected officials are.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, thanks for sharing that little bit. Let's get back to you then, and tell me now that you've gotten to this point in life, what keeps you busy these days?
Well, I'm officially retired now at age 75, but somebody neglected to tell me that said, to say that, you know, if you retire and you have four children, your wife's still working, you're going to be doing a lot of taking kids around and buying groceries and that kind of stuff. So I do those kinds of things, which is fine. It gives me a chance to spend time with the boys. I have one who's almost 17. He's a junior at Central High School, and then three 14-year-olds that are eighth graders, and they're going to be going to Central next year. But they're at an age when I sometimes just love listening to them talk to each other. They converse with each other. They seem to get along well. I can't say they're academic all-stars, but they're all four smart young men, and they have their own views on things. And some of the probably the biggest activity right now that I spend time on, aside from kind of domestic stuff, is I'm a member of the board of the Sultana Historical Preservation Society. It's a group that's mostly folks from Marion, Arkansas, over in East Arkansas on the Mississippi River, and we're raising money to build a new top-notch museum to tell the story of the steamboat Sultana. And I know that there are people listening to this podcast that are going to say, what in the hell is the Sultana? But in 1865, April 1865, the Civil War was over, except that technically the surrender hadn't occurred, but everyone knew who was winning. The Confederate prisoner of war camps at Andersonville and Cahaba, Alabama, were being emptied out of the Union prisoners of war. They made their way to the Mississippi River and loaded up on the steamboat Sultana, and it was equipped to handle about 325 passengers. And because of bribery and all this kind of shenanigans, people wanting to make money, it was overloaded with almost about 2,000 people. And it came up river, gets to Memphis, pushes off from Memphis after loading up with coal and all about 2 a.m., April 27th, 1865. The river is 2 miles wide from flood stage. It gets about 7 miles upriver. And the shoddy repairs that had been done on a boiler or two a few days before, the boilers blew. And the result was almost 1,200 people died. Almost all of them were emaciated, weakened, sick, former POWs. It's the worst maritime disaster in American history, you know, inside the United States. But because it was the end of the Civil War, and because John Wilkes Booth was shot the day before, Americans were tired of war, and the survivors and their families never felt like people respected what the horror and the sacrifice that occurred that night on that boat. So we're raising money. Fundraising is going very successfully to this point to tell that story, led by John Fogelman and the Fogelman family. And there's some other families, the Barton families. Their great-great-grandfathers were awakened by that explosion, saw what was happening, saw men, mostly men, floating down the river, grabbing on the trees, the tops of trees that were sticking above the water, and they made these little two-log rafts and paddled out. And John actually has a list of the 27 Union prisoners of war that his great-great-grandfather, who had been a Confederate, rescued out of the water. So it's a remarkable story. It's a remarkably human story. I'm going on and on, but I'll tell you one more thing, since I have you trapped here and you can't get out of this. What was interesting, there had been a group, and if you read Mark Twain, you knew that there were steamboat accidents. Boilers blew and killed people, but never to this level and these numbers. And there had been a group meeting of engineers and so on for a couple of years before that saying, what are we going to do about steamboat safety? When this thing occurred, and the absolute disaster it was in terms of numbers and just the carnage of it and how they died, that group got together and said, enough talking, we've got to do something. And there is now a group, a very successful international corporation, is now owned by a group out of Germany. It's called the Hartford Steamboat Insurance and Inspection, or something like that, HSB. And basically, this group came together, and from the Sultana came this group that still is alive today. They do boiler inspections all over the world. They do insurance for these kinds of things all over the world. In their foyer, as you walk in to this business in Hartford, Connecticut, they had a large painting of the Sultana burning on the Mississippi River to remind them of why they were there and what they're there for. But that was that business. And that corporation, by the way, gave $1 million, and their CEO came to Marion for our groundbreaking a few months ago just to say this story is really, really important to us and to safety. I'm done talking about the Sultana, April. You can rest easy.
I love that story, and I've never heard that story before. So, and Vic, thank you for sharing that. You know, even as you were talking about this person that was telling the story about the great-great-grandfather who was a Confederate that helped rescue the Union soldiers, you know, that illustrates, because they were focusing on the humanness of the people, that illustrates really what we are trying to do with this this podcast, in which we try to focus on, you know, and have communication conversations with community leaders who have reached across various divides to work towards common good. And that's what you all are trying to do here in bringing up that history, but also, you know, trying to improve the safety and those kinds of, keep those accidents from happening in the future, even though steamboat is not our primary way of traveling anymore. I know, Vic, you've had the chance to work with groups over the years who have differed from you politically and in other ways. And I'd love to hear maybe a story or two about how you were able to bridge a gap with someone else, somebody that disagreed with you in your various roles.
Well, let's see. Maybe I'll make a couple of comments if I can. I'll say one and hope I can remember my second one. But when I was in the state Senate, there was a wonderful man in the state Senate from Texarkana named Wayne Dowd. Wayne has been dead for quite a few years now. But, you know, you can always learn from people who have been in political office for a while, like, okay, why is this bird still here? You know, what is their magic, or how do they keep surviving elections? And one of the things I learned from Wayne, really smart lawyer, he made a comment one time, I think it was on the Senate floor, he said, it's a lot easier to defend a vote back home when you actually believe in the vote that you made. And, you know, no matter how controversial, if you vote against what you actually believe is the truth, it's really hard to defend it back home. And I think that's a pretty good lesson for politicians. So for me, I always found it worked best for me, just try to figure out what was best for Arkansas, what's best for the country, what's best for the future, what's best for kids going forward, and then make your case. And even people who may not disagree with you. I had a good friend of mine who was a Republican county chairman in one of the counties in my district, and he always liked running into me. He said, Vic, I didn't understand your vote about such and such. And we'd sit and we'd talk it through, and you know, he always respected why I reached a different conclusion than he did. He was just a wonderful man. Probably my favorite story about kind of across the aisle kinds of stuff, there's he's a former member now, and he was a former chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, a Republican from Texas named Mac Thornberry. I don't know what Mac's doing now. He might be working in the D.C. area. He's no longer in Congress. But he was a term or two ahead of me. I came in January of 97, and he'd been there a term or two before me. But he took a great issue. This was now the late 90s, the mid to late 90s. The Cold War was over, but the world was still trying to figure out how to adapt to that. Russia was still trying to figure out how to adapt to it. There were still nuclear missile silos in countries like Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan and places like that. And we spent significant amounts of U.S. dollars to help these nations get rid of nuclear silos that they did not want and to break down and process nuclear weapons that they did not want. Now, there were some people who said, now, what are we doing spending U.S. dollars doing these kinds of things for what are old communist countries? Well, it seems so obvious to Mac. He took a leadership issue or a position on this issue early in these discussions. You know, we're using our dollars to tear apart weapons that had been targeting us. What's wrong with that? Well, there was a vote, and as I recall, the vote lost on the House floor. Mac was pretty sophisticated, even at a relatively new member, as a new member. And he regrouped, and he was able to bring something back and successfully pass that to restore those funds and make sure that this program was well-funded. Well, I sent him a little handwritten note and just said something like, you know, Mac, most of the time people don't notice what any damn House member does, but I did, and I really appreciate you what did, you did on this issue. The next thing I know, he invited me to go on a foreign trip with him, the idea being the more information that we had firsthand about how this money was being spent, the better we could advocate for it in future budget cycles. And so I went with him, recognized even more so what a remarkable man he was and is. And we visited stuff. We actually went to a Ukraine site, drove out several hours through the rich Ukraine soil to what had been a former missile silo. And they actually let us, Mac and I, turn the key that blew off a chunk of this hardened missile silo. Now, they had learned, these contractors, and these were U.S. contractors, that there's a reason they were called hardened, because they put all these explosives in certain positions and they turn the thing and some little piece of concrete would fall off of it, and then they have to go back and start over. But anyway, Mac and I got to be very good friends on that, and that was the kind of issue that by its nature really should be a bipartisan issue, and as probably should a lot of the issues. But Mac and I, have, through our time together, worked on that issue together. Does that answer your question, April?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we're thinking about effectively communicating and working with others who differ from us, I mean, the fact that you reached out and complimented him, and he then reached back out and actually invited you, and you all were able to find some things to work together on, I mean, that does certainly illustrate that.
I think there's you know, I've not been up there for whatever it is now, 11, 12 years now. And of course, the events of January 6th, when there really was, you know, death in the Capitol and all, I'm sure there are lingering effects of that. But I am also quite confident that there continues to be member-to-member conversations, discussion, inquiries about kids and grandkids, playing basketball in the gym, you know, eating dinner. I'm confident that there continues to be relationships that had been going on for some years before January 6th and will continue going forward. A lot of the members that you wouldn't recognize them if they were on TV, you know, there's 435 House members. And most of us know just very few of them by name when we see them being interviewed or something. I'm confident there's still a lot of personal relationships going on. Obviously, there's things going on in our political dynamic in America that makes for a pretty polarized and seemingly more personal than in the past. But I still think there's probably a lot of person-to-person goodwill going on.
When you were in Congress, did you move your family to Washington?
No. When I went to Washington, I was a 49-year-old, never been married bachelor. When I got out, I was married with four children. So something happened along the way. And in fact, I did not know my wife when I went in to Congress. We had one child and had our first baby. My wife's a Methodist minister. And I did not like being apart. You know, you have this wonderful miracle of this baby, and it was, you can't talk to a baby on the phone, obviously. And we got to the point of where we explored the possibility of her getting a church in the Washington area, because I talked to members who did move their family up there, and they felt that it worked really well because, you know, when your family's in Arkansas and you come home to Arkansas, you want to spend a lot of time with your family. So then you're still torn about, well, how do I get out in the district if I'm holding my baby? You know, so you have those issues. I talked to quite a bit to one of the members up there who moved his family up there, and he said when he goes home, he hits, you know, Thursday night or Friday morning, whenever he gets there in his district, and for 2 or 3 or 4 days in a row, he's just wearing his staff out, but he gets a whole lot done in his district, a whole lot more than the members who go home and have young children to also deal with. So, you know, in terms of from the district's perspective, I don't think that they get cheated by members who do move their families up there. We explored the possibility. In fact, I drove around one night and looked at a couple of churches. They said, well, these two need pastors right now. It was not long after that I forget where the timing was and us trying to get pregnant again, but that we found out that we were not only pregnant but pregnant with triplets, and that just flat out ended any discussion about moving. Or first you're in a high-risk pregnancy, and then you know you're going to have 4 babies, and you just can't move to some place where you have no support system. My wife was the 5th of 5 children in her family, but her youngest sibling was 16 years older than her. So it was like for the first one of them has passed away, but for the first, you know, 12, 13 years of having these children, it was like having 4 sets of grandparents in Arkansas, and they're wonderful people.
Yeah, the reason I was asking that question is because I had heard that some people talk about that the reason why we have some such rancor in our current Congress is that they don't move their families there because so they don't, you know, their kids don't play on the same ball teams. They don't go to the same schools or go to churches together. And so that was the reason why I asked that question, because you were talking about building relationships, and perhaps they do have relationships that are being built even without their families there. But that was one thing I thought about.
Yeah, I think Newt Gingrich, who was speaker when I was in Congress for part of the time I was there, I think he was a negative force on relationships between members for a variety of reasons. One of the things he did was he wanted the power, and he wanted to keep the power, and he had very short work weeks. So if you only had 2 or 2.5 voting days and then you'd send everybody back home, it was peculiar. You just did not have time to do the work. Committee meetings were stacked on top of committee meetings. There was very little time to go out and have dinner with another member. I do think that just because you don't live up there doesn't mean that you can't have a lot of time to hang out with members if you have a more normal work week, and I certainly did.
Okay. Vic, this is probably an obvious one, but I'm going to ask anyway, because we usually ask our guests about their political leanings, and in Brave Angels we usually refer to it as red or Republican conservative leaning, and blue is the liberal Democratic leaning. So given your history as a Democrat, I would assume that's the case. Can you elaborate any, or is it just a plain old blue?
You know, I have never thought of applying those colors to an individual, and I don't think I ever want to do that. I don't think I want to start referring to a person, oh, he's a red, or she's a blue. I don't see any value in that. I think people, I mean, these colors came about from military maps when we had red forces and blue forces, and purple was considered a joint force, you know, all the different branches of the military. And I understand why we would do that for a political map. My own preference would probably be if, rather than say, oh, that's a red state, to say, well, for the last 6 elections, presidential elections, they voted for the Republican. But I guess it's easier to say red or something. But I don't want to apply those terms to any individual and it's almost like a dismissive, you know, they've had a very complicated, you know, and long career, and they spend a lot of time analyzing issues, and, oh, they're red. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. Obviously, I was a Democratic office holder, but in each party, I mean, there's some pretty broad spectrum of views and approaches to things. Probably not as broad as it used to be, but there's certainly both parties have a lot of, I won't say they're outliers, but when you look at the range of views within any political party, it's pretty broad.
Yeah. Well, regardless of how you describe your color, can you tell me a little bit about the kinds of life experiences or the values that you've developed that you think most led you to your political leanings?
Yeah, I think of some of the issues that, confronted the country and still confront the country, I was raised in Southern Oregon, and when I was, I don't know how old I was, 2 and a half or so, you know, my dad was one of Patton's Army veterans. He was not in the tanks himself, although he would tell me horrendous stories of having to take bodies out of burned out tanks as part of what he did with the 4th Armored Division in World War II. But, you know, I'm the classic post-war baby, being born in 1947 after these guys got out of the Army in late 1945 and come back and find wives and marry and start having babies. But when I was somewhere like 2 and a half and my mother was pregnant with my sister, they split up and he took off and she never remarried. So I was raised by a single mom who tried really, really hard to be organized and do everything she could to provide for her children at a time when working conditions and wages for women were not great, and not as great opportunities as there were for men. So it would come out, you know, in things like I supported the big healthcare reform bill votes in 2009-2010. But one of the reasons was I can remember as a kid when I'd get sick, you know, we would drive. My mom had a friend who was a nurse. We'd drive by, and she'd come out and pull my pants down around my butt and give me a shot of penicillin out there in the car, because that was cheaper than going to the doctor. Because going to the doctor meant that you had to pay money. There was no health insurance for children. And I remember one time I fell out of a tree doing some jumping off of a fence and leaping into the tree and grabbing the limb, which I missed, and breaking my shoulder. And, of course, the first thing, that was a huge issue for a single mom with two kids in terms of how you pay for that. It turned out we were living in a tiny little rental in the back half of a back fourth of a property. And the guy who owned the property and lived up front, he had health insurance, accident insurance that covered the whole property. And so that saved our butt on that one. But, I have firsthand memories of what it's like in a family not to have health insurance. I have very vivid memories of, my mother did a much better job than my wife and I do about giving our kids allowance. Kind of time slips by and we realize we hadn't done anything like that. But she whenever she got paid, she'd give us like 50 cents or whatever it was. But I can remember very vividly her coming at the end of a pay period, a day or two before she was going to get paid. And she did not have to do this, but she did. She would ask if she could borrow $2 or $3, either to put some gas in the tank, or she wanted to buy some more milk or something like that, and then she would pay it back when she got paid that pay period. I mean, that's the classic living from paycheck to paycheck. I think life is much more complicated now. The need for the expensive technology and phones is much greater now, and all this kind of stuff. So I think it's even more difficult now for lower-income people with children to provide for their children. So I think that certainly has shaped a lot about how do you create the kind of environment in this country that we want so that our kids and families can productively lead their lives. It doesn't mean they're going to get all these kind of giveaway stuff. It doesn't mean they're not going to have to work. But it does mean there are certain basic things that contribute to a strong America, and frankly, I would say contribute to a strong business climate. If families have health insurance, and it's portable, that really takes pressure off of business, and it does mean that entrepreneurs can go out and try new stuff. It means businesses can expand without worrying about the cost of health insurance, if people have a health insurance. I mean, I think there's a whole lot of issues about what I was having to face, you know, 70 years ago as a five-year-old that there are still families today having to face.
I actually really like hearing about people's personal stories to help us understand where they might be coming from and hearing about your growing up situation. Yeah. So I did have a question related to this. You know, we can't always have our conversations go smoothly, and we often, these days, it seems like there's an increased amount of incivility and sometimes even overt hostility that we see. And I'm wondering, how do you respond with conversations or when conversations take a negative turn that might seem like they're going in that direction?
Well, let's see. I guess there's certain, I assume we're talking more about political discussions than, you know, Thanksgiving dinner discussions. First of all, I mean, conversations have to take a negative turn. And the reason I say that, I mean, I feel very, how do I want to say it, simplistic in my view of American democracy. But we reached a conclusion as a country, and then we all reinforce it, you know, every election we go cast our votes, that we think the best way to settle disagreements is at the ballot box and not with guns. So, yes, we may have harsh discussions, but we are going to settle them, and we may have irreconcilable differences. I absolutely know there are people that I have with whom I have irreconcilable differences, but that we made a decision as a country to settle those at the ballot box, and we're going to have nasty ads, we're going to have arguments, and we're going to send nasty notes to our congressman, but we're going to settle it at the ballot box. We're not going to settle it with violence. So I am never shocked nor particularly alarmed when I, you know, realize that, gee, there's two people running for office that, at least publicly, they don't seem to like each other at all. They don't seem to have anything in common. They seem to be trying to demonize, and from their perspectives, I can understand why they might think that the other person is the devil. But that's why we have, you know, voting and made our decision in this country to settle those differences. I also think that the events of the whole President Trump's refusal to accept the election results, and then leading into that whole January 6th thing, which to me was a terrible, terrible event. But the worst part of it may be this continued denial of election results, because that is the essence of democracy. If you take away acceptance of election results, you're saying, I want some other method for settling our disputes. What's that going to be? People in the streets? Apparently, that's what he tried. Guns in the street? Well, there are some people that have tried, or, you know, we know there are individuals that are trying that. I think it's a very ominous thing if you find yourself saying, gee, I don't really like that candidate. I mean, I'm a Democrat in Arkansas. I'd like to see a lot of these folks that I know lose an election or two and put some different people in. That hasn't happened, and I know why it hasn't happened. My side lost. You know, so what do I do? I got to figure out how to win elections. I mean, that's what the essence of a democracy is. And I do think it's ominous, though, if people like me in losing sight start saying, well, I got to figure out how to do something different than elections. You know, what am I going to do? You know, and the essence of our democracy and these difficult conversations and the arguments and all is that you accept the results. So that's the first thing I would say, April. The second thing is I just think that there is a whole lot to the art of discussion and conversation and personal discussions and political discussions and public discussions that can be either good or bad. And we could spend all day, I guess, talking about that. One of the things that kind of drives me a bit batty is I can understand why someone may look at a problem and reach a different result. And I'll make something up. Glenn and I are being attacked by a polar bear. I reached the conclusion that the best thing is for me to run like hell. Glenn reaches the conclusion the best thing to do is to take advantage of the fact that we have high-powered rifles and shoot the little guy and end our problem. Two different approaches, dramatically different approaches, but we at least agree, hey, there's a polar bear trying to get us. I find it really unhelpful when we look at issues like climate change. And I think for 20 years, the information has been undeniable. And that something is happening and has happened that's changing the earth as we know it. And I think this country would really benefit from hearing potential solutions and ideas from people across the political spectrum, including the most far-right, pro-business conservative there is, about what would be some market incentives to help get this thing going in the right direction. What are some trade deals and some details of trade agreements that could help turn this thing around? I think we're missing out when that spectrum of our politics are convinced that the best thing is, or their leaders, I would say this way, or their leaders say, no, the best thing is just kind of to poo-poo it a bit and kind of drag feet on it. We're missing out on some potential solutions from across the political spectrum, and I think we need all the solutions. And one of the reasons we need all the solutions is no one bill is ever going to solve something, but sometimes it just you pass something that gets it started, and it snowballs in ways that were unpredictable. By that I mean you start doing something that looks like, well, this looks like, man, maybe there is some advantages to having an electric car, and boom. Now the auto industry is saying, we've got to lay off our internal combustion engineers. We've got to start hiring battery and electricity guys. And that's already happening. And because the snowball is starting to roll down the hill and has been for a while.
You know, I like what you have to say about, you know, solving problems with votes rather than guns. One of the concerns I have is how much there has been a kind of a win-lose mentality in our government lately, so that you can't allow any legitimate point to be made by the other side, it seems to me, I think. And so that means nothing gets done, no compromise, there's not enough votes to ram something through of importance in most cases. So I think it's important that we find ways to find at least some common ground and to compromise as you're talking about. So just as a kind of a thought exercise, can you identify maybe an issue or two that you think currently divides reds and blues and yet might offer the possibility for finding some common ground if people on both sides get together and talk it through?
Well, I think that's true of every issue. I mean, you can take any issue of which there is dramatic disagreements and find areas where, if you choose to, that you could work on. I talked a bit ago about healthcare. I think there's advantages to the most strong pro-business person, for that person to recognize, and I think some do, that it's the advantage of the business climate if Americans have health insurance. We have laid that burden on businesses, and it worked for quite a while, and then technology and I don't know what all led to dramatic increases. Medical inflation was so much higher than wage inflation that it really became a burden on business. You all may not recall, because this was going on, let's see, I guess 15 years ago or so, my first big clue that something was going to happen with healthcare at some point in a major way, and it happened in the Obama administration, was Walmart and the Service Employees Union got together and said, something big has got to happen in healthcare. This is unsustainable. And they began doing dog and pony shows all over the country. So there you had Walmart that people perceived as being this anti-union, you know, pro-business, the world's biggest business. They were aggressively doing forums with their buddy in this, the Service Employees Union, to talk about what are options for dramatically changing the healthcare system. And why were those two entities doing that? Because the service employees recognized that they had the lower scale wage folks and healthcare was a killer. And Walmart, at that time, it was, I guess, the biggest corporation in the world, recognized this is a killer for business. And so when you have entities like that come together and say, you know, what's wrong with having a good business climate? What's wrong with treating lower wage scale employees right by health insurance? That's a pretty big coming together. But I think you can take any issue and find areas where there are things that you could work on. And then there's also going to be things that you're going to have disagreements about.
Well, we've run out of time for now, but we have many more things to talk about. So stay tuned for the second part of our conversation with Vic Snyder.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. We also thank the Central Arkansas Library System's Roberts Library for the use of their recording facility for this interview. From your host, Glenn White, let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.